ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Thursday, the 25th of April. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, New South Wales bail laws under review after the alleged murder of young woman Molly Ticehurst. Advocates say more needs to be done to protect women from domestic violence. And Sydney uni students join the wave of pro-Palestinian demonstrations that swept through US colleges.
And there's graduation ceremonies happening next week, and I know the university cares very much about the graduation ceremonies. By prolonging this, you know, and keeping this disruptive action ongoing, we do cause a bit of a pain in the neck of UCIS management.
From the Australian War Memorial and capital cities to the smallest of rural communities, large crowds have marked Anzac Day. The tributes began in New Zealand, where thousands commemorated those who served. On the Kokoda Track in Papua New Guinea, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese took part in a dawn service with his PNG counterpart James Marape after the pair spent 2 days hiking part of the route. More than 600 Australians were killed on Kokoda in World War II, and Mr Albanese says it's important to honour their sacrifice.
In our pride, we feel the weight of history as we gather here along the Kokoda Track, this great artery of mud and suffering and perseverance that has come to occupy a place of singular power in Australia's shared memory. Anzac Day has never asked us to exult in the glories of war. Anzac Day asks us to stand against the erosion of time and to hold on to their names, to hold on to their deeds.
Many Sydneysiders turned out in the pre-dawn darkness at the cenotaph in Martin Place. Servicemen and women, along with veterans and families, gathered together.
It's the first time we've been to Martin Place for a dawn service, so it's a very special occasion, and I'd like the kids to experience it.
It's been a great experience to come in here and commemorate with the rest of the country.
Well, I volunteered for the what is now called the Army Reserve when I was 17. I also volunteered to go to Vietnam. I actually wrote a letter to the Minister of Defence saying I'd like to be posted to a unit to go to Vietnam. It was about getting on with what you were training for. I've been coming here now for over 50 years. To me, it's all about remembering those who I knew who are no longer here today, those that I knew who we lost in Vietnam, and of course many since.
Anzac Day is a very important day for myself, having served in the military, and to bring my children and continue the tradition to show them how important it is to mark this day and be grateful for the sacrifices of those who have served.
We who are gathered here think of those who went out to the battlefields of all wars but did not return. We feel them still near us in spirit. We wish to be worthy of their great sacrifice.
20 years of my life I dedicated to the Army. I served overseas as well, and I've come today to Sydney to march with my unit, and it means the world. I served with a lot of guys, and a lot of guys have passed away. It's a special day, and I'll never stop coming to Anzac Day. It's very important to me.
Some of the voices and sounds from Martin Place in Sydney this morning. Well, Anzac Day is not only a day to commemorate those who served, but also their families. Susan Chuck is the mother of Commando Private Benjamin Chuck, who died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan in June 2010.
Anzac Day has always been important to me, or to my whole family, having a grandfather and a father that served. And I can remember marching as a schoolgirl in a nurse's little outfit in my little village where I grew up. But I guess since losing Ben, it's taken an even deeper meaning personally. I mean, every day you remember, but it's just Anzac Day, it makes you reflect on the total sacrifice of our young servicemen and women, and a day that I think should be nearly Australia Day because it represents everything to us. I sort of celebrate it. I get very emotional, but I sort of celebrate the fact that we can be so proud of them.
Is it ever hard for you some Anzac Day? Have you ever thought, particularly after losing Ben, that you didn't want to go to the service?
It's a very somber time during the service of reflection, but afterwards we get together and celebrate life, I guess, yeah, and honour them in the best way we can.
The troops are well and truly home from Afghanistan. How important is it to continue to remember the families of those who served and those who continue to serve?
Personally, I think it's very important. It's nice to know that people remember the sacrifice your family member made. And I do get messages all day from our friends, and I contact still serving members and their families. To me, yeah, I think it's important. If you know somebody that has served or is still serving, just touch base on Anzac Day. Yeah, it's important.
I was at the dawn service at Martin Place in Sydney this morning, and gathering very quietly after the end of the service were some of the families of the young men who died in the Taipan helicopter crash, military helicopter in July last year. It looked very, very raw still for them. How much do you feel for the families who are going on some of the path that you and your family had to go on?
It's a tough road. Obviously, I feel very much for them. And, of course, when we lost, you know, another one the other day in that parachute accident, another commando.
Jack Fitzgibbon.
Oh, I feel for them, yes. It's just a tragedy and such a waste of such fine young lives. So, yes, I do feel for the families and the journey they've started on.
How do you reflect on Ben on this day? Is he forever that young man, or is there a parallel thinking of what might have been for you sometimes?
Oh, both. Of course, you remember him as he was, as a 27-year-old, young, fit, beautiful person. But then he would have been 41 this year. And I think he would have had family. Yes, I think of him as the young man, as the young boy even. I think of him in all different ways and what we've missed and not been able to share with him.
I can always hear when we talk. I can always hear so much pride there for you in Ben.
Mm. Oh, I think we all feel the pride in our boys. They were remarkable, all of them. They're just wonderful young people that have made the ultimate sacrifice. Yes, I am very proud of him. Very proud, and miss him dreadfully.
Very proud mother there. That's Susan Chuck, the mother of Private Benjamin Chuck, who died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan in June 2010. You're listening to The World Today. An emergency meeting has been called by Australia's Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence Commissioner in the wake of the alleged murder of 28-year-old mother Molly Ticehurst. A New South Wales magistrate court has heard her former partner, Daniel Billings, was on bail after being charged with her rape, in addition to stalking and intimidation. He's since been charged with her murder. A national roundtable is scheduled and a review into bail laws is underway. But some advocates say much more needs to be done to protect women at risk. Stephanie Smale reports.
For women who leave violent partners, the danger often continues. Family violence prevention advocate Rosie Batty says if they survive, too many women live the rest of their lives in fear.
I meet women across Australia who've had to change their names, change their identity, move into state away from the family and communities, live anonymously in fear and always looking over the shoulder because they know he will never rest until he tracks them down.
The alleged murder of Molly Ticehurst by her former partner, who had also been charged with violent offences against her and received bail, has sparked an urgent review of bail laws in New South Wales. It will look at why he was granted bail and whether broader reform is needed. But Rosie Batty says change isn't happening fast enough, arguing tightening bail laws won't guarantee women's safety.
I've been saying this for 10 years, that one woman a week is being murdered. And yet we still have to fight so hard for people to take it seriously when we live in fear of our lives, when we approach the police, when we go to court. Things have improved. Definitely things have improved. But the onus of safety still rests on the victim.
Domestic Family and Sexual Violence Commissioner Michaela Cronin has called a national roundtable for authorities and services in the sector. She says major efforts are underway across the court system and with policing to better protect women, but she admits there's a long way to go.
Look, I'm not saying we've got it right. I think everybody recognises that we need to improve and that all parts of the system need to lift their game.
Commissioner Cronin argues it's also time to look at the men who are assaulting and killing women.
The vast majority of our service response has been women's refuges. I think one of the things that I feel very hopeful and encouraged about is the men that are standing up and taking leadership. The Prime Minister has come out repeatedly and said that this is a national crisis that needs to be addressed by all men. The Attorney General, the Chief Justice of the Family Court. In the last week, we have seen men step up and say, this is not good enough and we need to see change.
There is work happening to shape the ideas and behaviour of men. Hunter Johnson is the CEO of The Man Cave. It's an organisation that helps teenage boys develop emotional intelligence, learn how to form respectful relationships, and about consent.
But I can tell you now, after working with about 70,000 boys across the country, whilst we have some tragic statistics in the media at the moment, which we must continue to address, there is a whole lot of hope because these boys are showing up.
Hunter Johnson argues the idea of masculinity is changing and can be confusing, which helps people like hypermasculine social media influencer Andrew Tate get a foothold in their lives.
You're basically giving, you know, a slot machine or a pokies machine to a child every time they watch TikTok. You know, the algorithm will just feed them more shocking and sensationalized content because it will keep them engaged. And so you really kind of got this bin fire unfolding right next to the developmental psychology of a teenager.
Hunter Johnson says it's time to put more funding and effort into shaping the ideas of men when they're younger.
We know that boys in a room being talked to directly, openly and respectfully, and where they can ask the politically incorrect or the messy question and not worried about being shamed or cancelled, we're able to see statistical behaviour change.
Initial findings from the New South Wales Bail Laws Review are expected by the end of next month.
That's Stephanie Smale. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. Five teenagers have been charged with a range of terrorism and extremism offences following the alleged stabbing of a bishop and a priest at a church in Sydney's west last week. A joint counter-terrorism task force was established after the incident to investigate whether a wider network of individuals was involved. Now, three teenagers have been charged with conspiring to prepare for and plan a terrorist act. Rachel Mealy reports.
400 New South Wales Police and Australian Federal Police yesterday swarmed across 13 locations in Sydney's southwest and in Goulburn, and seven arrests were made. Today, five teenagers have been charged with terrorism offences. Police will allege there's a connection between the teenagers and the stabbing at a church in Sydney's west last week, and that the group belongs to a violent extremist ideology.
AFP Assistant Commissioner Chrissy Barrett spoke yesterday after the raids.
As part of our JCTT investigation into the alleged Wakeley stabbing, we identified links between the alleged offender and a network of associates and peers who we believe shared a similar violent extremist ideology.
New South Wales Police Deputy Commissioner David Hudson says police felt the need to act quickly.
It was considered that the group subject of our attention posed an unacceptable risk and threat to the people of New South Wales, and our current purely investigative strategies could not adequately ensure public safety.
He says the radicalisation of young people is a concern for authorities.
We're talking 15, 16, 17-year-olds. However, the terrorism landscape and the radicalisation of youth online is a continuing problem for us when you think back 10 years ago this year to the murder of Curtis Cheng, killed outside police headquarters by a 15-year-old. Nothing's changed.
Dr. Josh Rooser is an Associate Professor of Politics at Deakin University and an expert in extremism.
The first thing police were always going to do was to seek to identify who his influences were, whether he was part of anything potentially a little bit larger. In this case, it appears that based on the evidence available in the media from the police, that there were a number of other individuals that he was associating with, young men, who were sharing extremist content amongst themselves and may have been a threat of further activity.
He says the extent of involvement of a wider network would be part of the investigation.
The key here is obviously the extent to which, A, there's a potential for imminent violence against the wider community. They'd be looking to see the extent to which any of these individuals were part of an actual plot, if anything, to attack people that would make some sort of symbolic target for them. Who was influencing them? I mean, what's critical here is that these were young men, primarily. The attacker at Wakeley was 16. Who's influencing them? Who's behind the scenes? Is this all primarily online? Are they gaining their material, you know, from international sources? Or are there potentially older individuals who might be influencing them behind the scenes? And that's critical because we need to know not only who the people who are radicalised are, but who's shaping them, who's inspiring them.
New South Wales Police and the AFP say the investigation has not targeted race or religion. Jamel Keir is the secretary of the Lebanese Muslim Association. He says he'd like to believe that, but is worried about inflammatory language that has previously been used.
I do believe that the police are acting in the best interest of the wider community. That is not debatable. I mean, we have faith in the police. What we don't have faith in is the rhetoric that's being used in enforcing the law.
That's Jamel Keir from the Lebanese Muslim Association, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. Police have broken up pro-Palestinian protests at campuses across the United States as students call for universities to cut ties with Israel. The movement has crossed over to Australia, where students say Sydney University must divest from Israeli universities. Angus Randall reports.
Across America, pro-Palestinian protesters occupy university campuses, demanding the universities separate themselves from companies supporting Israel's military campaign against Gaza. At the University of Texas in Austin, the riot squad was sent in. The movement began in New York at Columbia University last week. Student Haimani James says they won't leave until the university cuts ties to Israel.
Columbia University has once again cemented itself in history as a repressive institution that serves politicians and donors before anyone else. We expect the university to stop its fear-mongering tactics and join our student negotiators in good faith.
Columbia students were told to dismantle their camp yesterday. That deadline has been extended as negotiations continue. Bassam Hawaja is a supervising attorney and lecturer in law at Columbia Law School. He's told the ABC students are being arrested, suspended, and evicted from campus accommodation.
There's a lot of concern from the faculty that this is being done in a way that really quashes freedom of expression on campus. Columbia has a long history of, you know, protest against the Vietnam War, against apartheid in South Africa, and it does seem that the school is taking this particularly harsh approach against students who are speaking out in favour of Palestinian human rights.
The protests have got the attention of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel.
And speaking on Columbia campus, Republican Speaker of the House Mike Johnson says protesters have abused Jewish students.
A growing number of students have chanted in support of terrorists. They have chased down Jewish students. They have mocked them and reviled them. They have shouted racial epithets.
Protesters maintain they are not anti-Semitic, say many Jewish people are among the demonstrators, and they just want an end to Israel's bombing campaign. That demand is unlikely to be met. US President Joe Biden just signed a further $26 billion in military assistance for Israel.
My commitment to Israel, I want to make clear again, is ironclad. The security of Israel is critical. It will always make sure that Israel has what it needs to defend itself against Iran and terrorists it supports.
The US funding bill also includes around $1.5 billion in humanitarian aid for Gaza. The protest movement has spread overseas. Here in Australia, several hundred students on campus are calling on Sydney University to cut ties with Israeli universities and weapons companies. Declan Godwin is a Students for Palestine organiser and Vice President of the Sydney University Student Representative Council.
And we are demanding on the university that they cut ties with the weapons company Thales, the sixth largest weapons company in the world, which provides weapons to Israel, and which the university has a memorandum of understanding which allows for student and staff research to be used to improve and perfect Thales' military technology. We're also demanding that the university cut ties with Israeli academic institutions to stop legitimising and supporting apartheid.
SRC President Harrison Brennan says the uni will need to make a decision soon.
There's graduation ceremonies happening next week, and I know the university cares very much about the graduation ceremonies. And so this is to force them to actually divest. And I think by prolonging this, you know, and keeping this disruptive action ongoing, we do cause a bit of a pain in the neck of UCID management.
Sydney University says it remains committed to freedom of speech, but anyone breaching university rules will face appropriate action.
That report from Angus Randall and Alison Schau. Three men have been arrested on suspicion of immigration offences after five people, including a child, died as they tried to cross the English Channel. Two men from Sudan and one from South Sudan are being questioned by the National Crime Agency in the UK. Catherine Diss reports from London.
It was from here at Wimereux on the French coast south of Calais that the desperate journey began. A small boat carrying more than 100 migrants set sail for Britain on what would become an ill-fated journey. For the local mayor, Jean-Luc Dubelay, this latest tragedy is breaking point.
We must do something. We must act at the borders. We have to improve the security checks there. It's the British who are responsible for this situation. They pay us to keep quiet. I don't agree. Today, I'm sick and tired of it.
The migrants are among more than 6,000 who have attempted crossing the English Channel so far this year. Half of those on board were rescued by French authorities. The rest arrived at Dover Port, southeast of London. Three men aged between 19 and 22 have now been arrested by Britain's National Crime Agency on suspicion of facilitating illegal immigration and for unlawfully entering the UK. Craig Turner is the agency's deputy director.
This tragic incident, once again, demonstrates the threat to life posed by these crossings and brings into focus why it is so important to target these criminal gangs involved in organising them.
The deaths happened just hours after the British Parliament finally passed controversial legislation allowing for the deportation of illegal migrants to Rwanda. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak argues it will deter people from making the crossing. Kay Marsh from migrant rights charity Sampire isn't convinced.
We will not see the boat stop because of this. We will see more deaths. We will see more dangerous risks being taken. But yeah, it definitely won't act as a deterrent. Nothing else has. So I don't know why people are thinking that this will.
Nor are locals in Dover.
It's bonkers. It'll never work. We may as well give the money to them and let them settle here.
I just think it's just got out of hand over in the UK. I think the French need to do a little bit more than they're doing or what we're paying them to do.
The UK government has paid France hundreds of millions of dollars to bolster policing and surveillance of the Channel to reduce the number of asylum seekers making the perilous journey. But big questions remain, with thousands still reaching Britain's shores.
That's Europe correspondent Catherine Diss. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It must feel like a never-ending battle for Rupert Murdoch. His British newspaper group is continuing to face legal action more than a decade after the phone hacking scandal came to a head. Now he's settled with the actor Hugh Grant. Today, ABC Media Watch host Paul Barry on how Murdoch has paid out many millions to avoid trial. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.